to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Almgren, and we are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden. New and regular listeners, it's good to have you with us today. As you know, our website is redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. News, radio, webcast, videos, and much more. Don't miss it, so check it out. Okay, today we have Mike Barra with us. He is the co-author, together with Richard Hoagland, on a book called The Dark Mission. This is the secret history of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. Their website is darkmission.net, where you can read more about their book, the authors, and follow their blog, and of course get a copy of the book. I also want to mention that Mike was featured in a film called Moon Rising by Jose Escamilla recently on the similar topic of the anomalies and strangeness of the moon. And we've been trying to get Mike on the program for a while now. I'm very glad that we finally got a hold of him. I'm really looking forward to going into some of these areas here today. We got about an hour, so we have a lot of stuff to run through, but we're going to talk primarily about everything that has to do with the occult NASA moon program, anomalies on the moon, and so much more, especially considering what NASA is gearing up for now in October, when they're under the LCROSS program, is going to actually bomb the moon. I'm going to ask more about this later on and see if we can get Mike's take on this. But anyway, Mike Barra, welcome to Red Ice Radio. It's very good to have you with us today.
And thanks for having me, Henrik. It's good to be here.
Very good. Thank you again for spending some of your time with us today. And before we go into some of the main content of the book Dark Mission, I'd just like to ask you a little bit about yourself, how you kind of got involved or interested, rather, in the space program, in the moon, and especially the occult nature of the NASA moon program. How did you start this researching?
Well, I'm an aerospace engineer by trade. That's what I've done all of my adult professional life, and I've always had an interest in the space program from the time that I was a little kid. I used to, you know, I watched the Apollo moon missions at home, and my dad worked for a pretty large aircraft manufacturer in the Seattle area that you might have heard of. Yes. Out there. And, I just always had an interest and fascination with space and space technology and aerospace. And, you know, I also always had kind of a strange feeling that they weren't showing us everything and telling us everything, even from the time I was a little kid. And, I remember especially the Apollo 11 footage, watching it from the moon, and I remember thinking, my family had a color TV, which at the time was not highly unusual, but there were still plenty of black and white TVs around. Mm. But I remember thinking, wow, sitting right here, we can afford a color TV. Why can't they send a color picture back from the moon? Why is it such a terrible picture? And that always bothered me. So these things kind of always stuck in my head. And then as I grew up and became an adult, I started, getting interested in UFOs and things like that. And the problem with UFO stuff is that the cases never really were very concrete to me. They never were anything that I could really put my finger firmly on and say, yeah, you could prove this one way or the other.
Yeah.
But then I started listening to Richard Hoagland on the old Coast to Coast AM radio program here in America late at night, and he was talking about the face on Mars, and I remembered it from back in the 70s. I'd heard about it, and he seemed very convincing and very smart and very there's a lot of arguments that he made that I felt were not only very solid arguments, but they could be disproven, they could be verified. So that impressed me, and then later through a mutual friend I ended up meeting him and became more and more interested in what he was doing. And finally, just one day, I guess in about 10, 11 years ago now, in 1998, I just asked him if he wanted an article for his website, and he said sure, and I wrote it, and he liked it, and the working relationship kind of took off from there. So.
Okay, wonderful. And do you guys kind of specialize a bit in different areas? Is there something specific that you looked at versus what Richard brought to the table for this book?
Well, I think we're both pretty complementary of each other in terms of our thought processes. It's pretty odd. Some people kind of laugh at me when I say that we kind of think alike, and that frightens some people, But I think we're very similar. I mean, my area of specialization has been the what we call the ritual alignment model, which we can get into a little bit later, which is just the idea that, that NASA sort of follows an ancient Egyptian astrology in the naming of their spacecraft, and they land at certain times when the stars are in certain positions on the moon or on Mars and so forth. And that, that really became the thing that I was the most interested in as we started working together. But, you know, I kind of cover all aspects of it. The physics is a little bit more his realm than mine. But a lot of the, you know, the ruins and the artifacts and the architecture and the structural stuff I can relate to because I'm a structural engineer. So that, you know, I can definitely look at things that he's pointing out and see them in three dimensions, see them in my head and say, yeah, this is definitely looks to me like something that was built, not something that was just randomly formed by geologic processes. So
yes.
I guess the answer is, you know, that we do tend to specialize more in certain areas, but pretty much we overlap quite a bit. We're both sort of generalists. We both see the bigger picture.
And, you know, I'd like to ask you a little bit about, first up here, what you think about the moon in general. I mean, there has been a lot of research done on the fact that it might even be an artificial body, and later on here we can get into more detail on just the specifics about what NASA has been doing up there in the recent years. But if we talk about the moon as a whole, so to speak, what's your take on that? Do you think that there's something strange with the moon itself, its alignment and distance from the Earth, and just the composition of the moon-Earth relationship, so to speak?
Yeah, I will just, you know, not hesitate and say that I think it's artificial. I mean, there was a really terrific book written by a couple of guys a few years ago. I forget the title of the book and I forget the authors, but it maybe dig it up at some point. But, you know, where they basically laid out the case of the idea that the moon itself is most probably artificial. And they really did an excellent job of putting together arguments from some of the early researchers, people like George Leonard and then Richard's work and lots of other people that they put together. And I think the whole thing is artificial. The distance, you know, the exact circumference is 2,160 miles, okay, which is a very specific number that relates to, it's 2,160 years for the Earth to pass through one house of the precessional cycle. It's exactly the right distance between the Earth and the Sun and at the exact right size to make perfect solar eclipses. And I mean, you know, some people look at those things and they conclude that's a coincidence. And that's ludicrous.
Yeah.
You know, it helps generate the magnetic field that the Earth uses to protect us down here so that there can actually be life on the Earth. It sort of regulates the spin momentum of the Earth. I mean, there's all these factors that are involved, and the simple reality is that there would not be life on the Earth if it wasn't for the moon. There certainly wouldn't be any kind of advanced life like us here, and there's just way too many things about the moon itself that are remarkable, amazing astronomical coincidences for it to be a kind of a random thing. And also, as we look around, you know, the rest of the solar system and the other solar systems out there that we can observe, we don't see yet, maybe there will be, but right now we don't see any other similar relationships of two bodies of such similar size in a tidal lock. And you know, the theories about how the moon got there, the conventional ones about, you know, some Mars-sized planet hitting the Earth and breaking it off, I mean, to me those are just ludicrous. The reason that those models came out right is because they were programmed to come out a certain way in the first place. There's no way that something the size of the Earth could capture an object the size and the mass of the moon, I don't think. So the long answer is, yeah, I think the whole thing's artificial, and I think it's pretty obvious that it's artificial.
Hmm. So do you think that suggests that it's been built by someone then, or it's something else in the works here?
Well, you know, it certainly implies that this Earth that we live on is a special place and that we've all been, you know, we're here for a reason, that someone's watching over us and has created this opportunity for higher life to exist here the way it does. And so there's, you know, really far deeper implications of that assertion that the moon is artificial. And certainly whether it was gods with a small g or God with a big G that arranged this whole thing, I mean, you know, Richard and an old former colleague, the late Dr. Tom Van Flandern, used to have these fascinating discussions about the concept of designer solar systems, you know, like make up a solar system the way that you want to create life. And honestly, looking at Mars, looking at Venus, Mercury, I think that at one time there were probably three habitable planets, Earth-like planets, in the solar system, and now there's only the one left, which is us. Yeah. And that, you know, that's a shame, but I think that we're here for a reason, and I think that there's some involvement by some higher beings in the whole process at some point in the distant past, for sure.
Hmm. I don't want to dwell on this for too long, but what do you think happened? Why is there only one left now, then?
Well, we have a paper that's been on the Enterprise Mission website that Richard and I put together in, I believe, 2001, and it's titled the Mars Tidal Model, T-I-D-A-L, in terms of tides, tidal model. And essentially what that theory does is it takes the idea that the late Dr. Van Flandern came up with or really popularized, which is called the exploded planet hypothesis, that essentially says that there are at least two missing planets in the solar system, one that was in the orbit roughly where Mars is now, another that is in the orbit where the asteroid belt is now. And it kind of works to Bode's law, which is the idea that every planet is about twice as far from the sun as the previous planet.
Yes.
And so, you know, what we think happened was that there was kind of, as I like to put it, an inner Earth, which was Venus, an outer Earth, which was Mars, and a middle Earth, which is this one. And what happened was that the planet that Mars orbited, and Mars was not a planet per se, it was the moon of a much larger rocky terrestrial planet that Dr. Van Flandern called Planet V or Planet 5, and a lot of people have other names for it. But, you know, it's clear from the evidence of looking at the actual geology of Mars that it was formerly in a tidal locked arrangement around this larger parent planet, in the same way that the moon is in a tidal locked arrangement with the Earth, meaning that it orbits the Earth with the same face facing us at all times. We never see the backside from the Earth because it's in a tidal lock relationship.
Yes.
And as you look throughout the solar system, you see this tidal lock relationship between Jupiter and all of its moons, between Saturn and its moons, and large bodies and smaller bodies are always arranged this way, because what happens is that the larger body sort of strips away the angular momentum of the moon or the smaller planet and keeps it in that locked relationship. And what you get with that is you get bulges on both the moon and on the parent planet, facing each other. And you have a large bulge on the side facing the other body, and you have a smaller bulge on the opposite side of the planet 180 degrees around. And as you look at Mars, you see exactly that situation. You see clear tidal bulges. They could not be more obvious. They're gigantic. And one is much larger than the other. And then, of course, you have the southern hemisphere, which is massively cratered and just spattered with all sorts of debris. And, you know, to us, it's completely obvious, and I think the paper is about 45 pages, but it's completely obvious that Mars was in a tidal-locked relationship with a larger parent planet. That planet exploded. It blew up. We don't, you know, it's speculative whether that was an artificial destruction, whether it was a natural disaster. But, you know, we think that disaster was what basically wiped out life on Mars. It certainly would have spewed debris into the inner solar system. It probably is the event that, you know, killed the dinosaurs with the asteroid strikes on the Earth, nearly killed all the life here. And we think that Venus, if you look at Venus, there's a huge trough or trench cut pretty much right around almost the equatorial circumference of Venus. And we think what happened there was that a large chunk of this debris basically hit Venus kind of edge on around the equator and at thousands and thousands of miles an hour, and kind of stripped the planet and vaporized the oceans and created this horrible, you know, cloudy, steam venting kind of hell that Venus is now. So that's the theory. It's all laid out. I know that's a little more information than you wanted, but that's what we think is the situation. And now we're the only one left. So we've got a fragile existence. here that we have to preserve.
Absolutely. Sure. Well, it's a very interesting one, and we've been talking about similar ideas before in this program as well, so I think our audience will be familiar with the, you know, with Bode's Law and that something has happened in our solar system. Absolutely. And the question is then if we can I guess tie this in together straight away with NASA then. Do you think that NASA have any kind of information about this? Do you think that they hold this idea themselves, the occult NASA, so to speak, not the official NASA here?
Yeah, they have to be. I mean, the thing is, you know, Richard and I have had this conversation many times, which is that we can't be the smartest guys on the block. There has to be somebody else. There have to be other people inside NASA that look at this information and realize what it means. You know, they're not dumb. They understand what tidal bulges are. And so, yeah, absolutely, we think that they know about this. So clearly they must realize that we came, perhaps maybe even human beings came from Mars after the disaster that took the life, you know, away on that planet and ruined whatever civilization was there. And it's also possible, because there's so many of these secret societies involved inside NASA, it's possible that they already, you know, pretty much knew the story because this was passed down generation upon generation through these this priesthood, these secret societies that kind of dominate NASA on the inside.
Hmm. And do you care to mention some of these secret societies, which are you thinking about?
Yeah, in Dark Mission, you know, we describe them as the Masons, the Freemasons, the Nazis, and the Magicians is how we describe them. Mm-hmm. Those are the names we give them. Basically, we found those three groups primarily. The Freemasons were probably the dominant organization there. You had, you know, many of the astronauts, a number of them that walked on the moon were Freemasons. Many others that were in different missions were Freemasons. The gentleman who ran the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs named Kenny Kleinconnect, was not only a Scottish Rite Freemason, but his father and later his brother were both the actual titular head, the sovereign grand commander, they call it, of the 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemasons in the United States. Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, took a Masonic ceremonial apron with him on Apollo 11, and we think pretty clearly performed a Masonic ceremony on the moon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, in fact, we're going to have a revised edition of Dark Mission coming out this fall, I believe September or October. I think it's going to be September.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have more information on that. So we cover it in Dark Mission, but then we expand upon it and provide a little bit more evidence of something funky going on with the Masonic ceremony in the lunar module before they went on their first moonwalk.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this very strong Masonic influence. You have the Nazi influence, which is through Wernher von Braun and the rocket scientists that were brought over to America through what was called Project or Operation Paperclip back
yes.
in the war era. And, you know, von Braun was not simply a German rocket scientist. He was also a member of the Nazi Party. And even more than that, he was a member of Hitler's SS. And the SS was a secret society, just similar to the Freemasons. And the funny thing is that, you know, people don't really understand this, but the SS at their core belief system, the Nazi ideology and the Freemasonic ideology are essentially the same, and that they both worship these ancient gods of ancient Egypt, Isis, Osiris, and Horus. Those are the gods of both of these secret societies.
Mm.
So, you know, and then in JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out here in Pasadena, California, near where I live, you had they were running all the unmanned probes, all the lunar orbiter programs and so forth, and the founders of JPL were deeply involved with people like Aleister Crowley and L. Ron Hubbard, who, of course, now started the Church of Scientology. And I'm not necessarily saying Hubbard was involved in this, but Crowley was a Satanist and certainly... Well, I don't know if he was a Satanist, but he was a believer in the occult, and
right.
ultimately Crowley's belief system and the belief systems of Jack Parsons and people like that who founded JPL, they also worshipped Isis, Osiris, and Horus. So you have this very consistent theme, and these three secret societies all kind of vying for power behind the scenes in NASA, but all having essentially the same core root belief system about their, you know, the fact that they came from the stars, that human beings came from the stars, and so forth.
Yes. And what I guess we can say as well is that is essentially, as you describe it, through the Paperclip Project and whatnot, these secret societies have basically worked together in order to kind of achieve this goal of being able to put men on the moon. And to me, it almost seems like there's some kind of alchemical ritual almost to me of bringing the rocks of the moon to the earth, or moon dust.
Yes.
I don't know about that. What's your take on that, Mike?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. Now, I think like Apollo 11, I believe that they landed literally in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we argue that there are ruins, structures on the moon, but I don't think Apollo 11 landed necessarily anywhere near them. I think it was a ceremonial mission. I think it was pretty much symbolic. I think that definitely involved alchemical rituals. I think the purpose of Apollo 11 was to land at that particular place and time and perform a specific Masonic ceremony and come back. And in essence, what they were doing was they were consecrating the moon. They were definitely, you know, going there to sort of reclaim it for this version of the human race, which has roots, I believe, on these other planets in the solar system a long, long time ago. And, you know, I think there's always been a controversy of what exactly did Neil Armstrong say,
yeah,
and what exactly did he mean when he stepped off that first step on the moon. And he said, you know, it's one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind. And people keep saying, oh, he must have meant a man, one small step for a man, because that's the only thing that makes any sense. And they've claimed they've gone through and listened to the radio, and they think he really did try to say that, but it's not true. It's simply not true. He meant exactly what he said. And what he meant was that it's a small step for us, man, this current version of the much broader human family, but it's a giant leap for all mankind, which is the larger, similar family that I think has probably existed in this solar system for eons, for millions upon millions of years in all probability, and probably lived on Mars, and lived and built these bases on the moon, and lived on Venus. And, you know, after the cataclysm that sort of threw us back to the Stone Age, I think what he meant was, okay, now we're back. We're reclaiming that which is ours, which is not just the Earth, but the rest of this Eden, this Garden of Eden, this beautiful solar system that whoever it was made for us. And I think that's exactly what he meant. And that, yeah, there's a lot of alchemical ritual and so forth in all that.
Hmm. Well, that's really, really interesting. I wonder a little bit if they've been trying to go back again, so to speak, that they view this as a kind of a recovery mission in some way. And if we talk about that, I think that we can look at some of the project names, for instance, and some of the logos that NASA uses, and it seems to be that they, even on an official level, want to communicate this in some way. Would you agree with me on that point?
Yeah, absolutely, and we do talk about that in Dark Vision and show some of the program patches. And they're all, you know, there's things, for instance, the constellation of Orion appears on the official Apollo program patch, and that makes no sense if you buy into Greek mythology, which is the public mythology of NASA. Because Orion had nothing to do with Apollo. They were not the same. They were two different people. And why would the constellation of Orion be on this patch? And as you go back into the subtleties of that, you find that Orion was synonymous with the ancient Egyptian god Osiris, which, of course, we now know that the Freemasons and the Nazis and the magicians all worshipped as their god. So all through it, through the naming of spacecraft, you know, the lunar module for Apollo 16 was named Orion. You may as well have just named it Osiris.
Hmm.
And all these sort of symbols keep coming up over and over again all throughout NASA's history. And there's sort of an Egyptian, like an Egyptian motif, as we call it, that runs through NASA, especially in the early days.
Absolutely. And again, you mentioned before ritual alignment model. Is that something that dovetails with this as well, Mike?
Yeah. What we found, and Richard started this work initially back in the mid-90s. And then I really sort of kind of took it and went a little bit further with it. And what we found was that we believe that NASA, specifically selects landing dates and places and times with the idea that the stars will be in certain positions, certain power positions over the landing site. For instance, the constellation of Orion, let's say, Orion's belt stars, the three belt stars, we found that they very consistently are on the horizon or at 19.5 degrees or at 33 degrees above or below the landing sites when certain things take place, when landings take place, when different events happen. And we actually sort of laid out in Dark Mission, I think it's in Chapter 5, where, again, this Masonic ritual we talked about that Buzz Aldrin, we believe, performed exactly 33 minutes after they landed on the moon, which, of course, is a significant Masonic number. It's tied in with their numerology. Was done, and that the reason why they landed where they did and at the time they did and on the date they did, so that he could perform this communion ceremony, which is actually an ancient Egyptian ceremony, an offering to Osiris, with Sirius, star Sirius, at 19.5 degrees above the landing site. And if you get into the book, you'll understand what these different numbers mean and why they're significant to these secret societies. And yeah, I think, you know, we've really talked about it and pretty much stated that we think the entire Apollo 11 mission was designed around that specific Masonic ritual that Aldrin performed that day.
So, I mean, what is it now? It's almost 40 years since we at least officially went back to the moon. What has happened here, Mike?
In terms of why we haven't gone back? Or?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, you know, you kind of touched on it earlier. I think that, you know, Apollo 11 early on was kind of symbolic, and then after that they begin what we believe were salvage missions. I think that a bigger part of the Apollo program was to go to the moon and bring back not just rocks and dust, but actual artifacts, actual samples of this technology that built these incredible ruins that we see on the lunar surface. So especially, I would say, Apollo 17. We talk about Apollo 17 quite extensively in Dark Mission near the end of it. And I think that these were all designed to go and bring certain things back from the moon, bring back evidence, bring back proof of the gods, and bring back technology, hopefully, to be exploited and to be used in the space program or in private technology or for private technological development throughout the years. And I think the reason we haven't gone back is because we kind of got what we wanted. We found out what we needed to find out, and we didn't really want to, you know, we didn't want to go back, and we didn't want people to be focusing on the moon. And the problem now, I think, that NASA faces is that other countries have developed in the intervening 40 years the capability to go there and possibly go there with manned missions and sort of, you know, catch up with us. So now we find ourselves in a bit of a race to get back there again and to, you know, be sure that we can sort of micromanage or at least to some extent manage what they will find and what these other countries can get their hands on.
Yeah. So much I want to ask you about this, but do you think there could have been, I think you and Richard have talked about this, that there's some even private companies that have been involved in the space programs, like Bell Labs and AT&T. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And of course, you know, they essentially hired, you know, different companies to do different things, develop different technologies and so forth for the space program. And, you know, Bell Labs was one, or actually Bellcom was one, and they were they did a number of things in terms of managing and selecting the landing sites, which we've argued were picked for very specific reasons. They had certain things they were looking for at each one of these landing sites that were not simply geology and science. They involved salvaging of technology and so forth. And so, you know, that's been our argument. And these companies also did things like they developed a very, very special film that was taken to the moon and that was used for the photographs on the moon. And Richard is one of the few people who back in those days actually got his hands on some of this film and was able to take pictures with it. And as he put it at the time, he said, you know, you literally couldn't take a bad picture with this film. It was so fantastic. But curiously, you know, when the space program ended, when Apollo ended, the remaining film was destroyed. The lab where it was put together and designed and manufactured was destroyed. And the same film has never been made available to the public. And I think it's because it was just so good that they just wanted to keep that secret. They didn't really want anybody to know how they did it and what they did.
Hmm. Well, as a matter of fact, right now up on our website, redicecreations.com, we have a reprinted article from Reuters revealing that the moon landing tapes got erased by NASA, allegedly. Do you think that that's all a lie, or do you think that they're, you know, that actually happened? They don't care about this stuff?
I do suspect that that they did just erase them. Going back to the Apollo 11 landing and the crappy black and white camera, I think that they deliberately put, in fact, we demonstrate in Dark Mission that they had a vastly superior color camera. But truthfully, even though I think they thought they were pretty much landing in the middle of nowhere for their little ritual where there were no ruins around it, I think they were very, very concerned about what people might be able to see from the moon on TV. And so they pretty much deliberately put in a very, very low-grade black and white camera for the mission. And on top of that, we now know that the signal that actually was broadcast on television was dramatically lower resolution than what actually did come back to the receiving stations at Goldstone and then Australia and so forth. And what they've been looking for is those tapes, the actual higher quality tapes of the original slow scan TV signal, which was significantly better than what was actually ever broadcast on television. Now, personally, I don't really think there's anything on them. I don't think there's anything that we're going to see in terms of ruins in the background or anything like that. But I suspect that at some point that nobody really minded that they were ever erased, because I think it also was important for them, you know, to make sure that people didn't realize that they could have broadcast a much better signal. They could have shown us much better versions, and they chose not to. Hmm. Because on later missions, there were things, there were, you know, ruins in the background. There were things that we could have seen on television if the image quality had been higher. Right. And even later, as they did go to color cameras and did go to better cameras, they still used different processes to degrade the signal before it was ever broadcast on television to the world. So, yeah, it's a game. I suspect that exactly, you know, what they say happened probably did happen, that they were just, you know, not taken care of very well and erased.
That is weird in a way. And also, what I think about is that would imply that they already knew that there was going to be something on the moon. Do you think that they had a recon mission there and actually discovered it way back before they even set foot on the moon, that there were structures or some kind of anomaly there?
Well, I have a friend out here in Los Angeles named Sean David Morton, who's a fairly well-known guy. He's done a lot of, you know, radio and television shows on paranormal and UFOs and so forth. And Sean, as he was growing up, his dad was a high executive at TRW, who was one of the major, you know, companies involved with going to the moon. And he had a lot of astronauts over to his house. They had a nice place in Palos Verdes, and a lot of the guys, you know, Ed Mitchell and Gus Grissom. And Sean, as he was a little boy, he knew these guys. He grew up around these people. And he's told me on more than one occasion that Gus Grissom went on and on about how, scared he was and how angry he was, because he knew very well that NASA or the government had much, much better technology, that they'd been to the moon and been to Mars in the 1950s before they ever publicly went there, and knew everything that was there. And he was really frustrated because they got stuck with all of the low-tech, really crappy equipment. And, you know, he was concerned for his safety. And ironically, of course, Gus ended up dying in a fire at a test on Apollo 1. So, even the astronauts believed that we had been to the moon before, believed that we had better technology. Hmm. And I think the next book that Richard and I are talking about doing is going to be called The Secret Space Program. And we're starting to really develop a lot of interesting evidence that there certainly was other technologies that could have been utilized in making essentially flying saucers to go to the moon, but all done very, very secretly. So, yeah, I think they... To answer your question, I think they knew beforehand what was there and what they expected to find. But I also think that it's possible that these ancient secret societies and some of their writings and things that were passed down over the years, they might have even known from those way before the World War II era or way before we had any technology. They may have known from ancient times
Yes, yes.
that there were ruins on the moon and ruins on Mars.
Hmm. Really, really interesting. Do you think...
May have been passed down over the centuries, over the millennia.
Yes. Information lodged within the secret societies, and when they finally, so to speak, could have regained the technology that they were looking for, they made it to the moon eventually. And do you think that, and if there was an alternative technology used to reach the moon, would that give a little bit of credence to a lot of people who are criticizing the idea that we might not have gone to the moon with the technology that we're that they say that they went there with, if you know what I mean?
No, because we could get to the moon and back with the technology, the public technology that we've all seen. We could do it. Certainly they did do it. I've gone through those arguments. We talk about them a little bit in Dark Mission. None of the arguments hold up to my mind at all. I pretty much can shred any of them. What's happening, I believe, is that people are seeing the secrecy around the space program and wondering why the secrecy is going on, and they're jumping to the wrong conclusion, which is that they were hiding the fact that we never really went there. It was all done in the studio, and that's the wrong conclusion. The reality is, yeah, there is secrecy. There is reason for you to be suspicious, but what you should be suspicious about is that we went there, but we didn't tell people really why we really went there, what we really found, and what we really brought back.
Well, that's an interesting point.
I mean, if you want to do a show on the moon conspiracy thing, just bring me the charges, and I can talk about any of them anytime.
That would be interesting, actually. Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, I have a website called lunaranomalies.com, and I'm not sure. I may have to renew the internet, the internet the domain name on that. But on that website, we have a very extensive article that Richard and I and another researcher named Steve Troy worked on about the moon missions. It's called Who Mourns for Apollo was the name of the series. And it's about a four-part series where we kind of take apart all the arguments and show why they're wrong.
Interesting. LunarAnomalies.com for those who want to check out more on that. Then. Oh, very interesting.
That, again, I'm not positive it's still up. I have to renew the domain name on that at all.
Okay. How about the idea then that we haven't been back because there actually is an active, if I can say, use that word, active alien presence on the moon that we were warned not to go back. What about that idea?
It's feasible. I've certainly heard the stories, as we all have. I've seen, the supposed quotes from Neil Armstrong, but I've never, ever found them to have been verified in any way.
You were mentioning the potential active alien presence on the moon and some claims that from Neil Armstrong. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, Neil Armstrong is the one who supposedly is quoted as saying, there was these really big, impressive ships, and they were lined up on the rim of the crater, and they warned us not to go back. And I've heard these quotes, but I've never seen them substantiated anywhere. So, it would be one thing if he said that, and there was a tape, or there was two or three witnesses that could testify to it, but they're just, right now, they're just stories. And although I think you can use such anecdotal stories to support other evidence that you have, I don't think they stand as evidence on their own. So one of the things that's never made sense to me is, why would they let us go there six times before they told us to stop coming back? I don't know. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I think if that really was the case, it's just as likely that what happened was is that the public space program kind of tripped over the private space program that was already operating there, and maybe that did happen, where they kind of were warned by the private space program to stop poking around and just stay home for a while. I don't know. I can't put my finger on that. I can't really say that I can. I feel very confident that that actually happened.
Right. So what we potentially are looking at here then, and if we talk about what primarily you and Richard have been focusing on is what is on the moon right now, and that seems to be that there's a lot of ruins, some kind of structures. Richard had talked about the crystal towers, something called the shard, and things like that. What does that imply? Where do you think all this comes from? Is that our own previous civilization that had a presence on the moon, or are we talking about E.T. here?
Well, the thing is, we don't know. We don't know. But our speculation and the direction that we've been moving in for quite some time is that these are ruins of our previous advanced civilizations. I mean, even the Hopi Indians in America talk about that this is the fourth world, and that there was a previous world, a third world, where the technology was even far more advanced than it is today in the so-called fourth world, and that civilization was wiped out by some, you know, unimaginable cataclysm. And we have a space shuttle named Atlantis, and I'm thinking, you know, we've always wondered why we have a space shuttle named Atlantis.
Yes.
Maybe they're trying to sell us something. And the other thing about it is that the glass ruins, the architecture, what I see there, and there's all sorts of different levels of ruins and artificial stuff on the moon. There's these enormous glass scaffolds that seem to, you know, rise 10, 20 miles above the lunar surface. Below that, there are, in a couple cases, we have, I think, pretty clear evidence of glass domes, like a watch crystal kind of a dome over craters. And we see also geometric formations that look like cities and block, street blocks and ruins and stuff underneath that. So you have different levels of technology there. But all of it, as you look at it, looks human. It looks like architecture. It uses the, you know, as I look at the structural aspects of this stuff, these scaffolding structures, what I see is how I would design something like that if I was going to build it. I mean, I'm not an architect, but I am a structural designer. And so to me, it looks like human architecture. And then we ultimately go back to where this all started, which is actually on Mars, with the face on Mars, which at least half of it looks to me like a human face. And I can't imagine why aliens would build ruins that depicted a human face. So, you know, I tend to think it is ours from a previous, very advanced time in our history. That, you know, it's the ruins of mankind, the mankind that Neil Armstrong talked about on Apollo 11.
Mike, do you think that they bombed that face on the Mars, if we compare the pictures from the earliest, the Viking missions, and then I don't remember which the next version of the picture that we got was, but there was speculation that they actually destroyed it in some way. What's your take on that?
No, I've heard that, and I think that just came out of the fact that the first Mars Global Surveyor image in 1998, which is commonly kind of called the cat box image, because it looked more like something that a cat might dig up in his cat box, as opposed to litter box, as opposed to actually the face on Mars. Just because that picture was so bad, people started to say that. But no, what I see in all the different images of the face on Mars, and there are, gosh, I think at least 20 different images of the face on Mars have been taken now by different probes. They all show the same structure. Now, the interesting thing is that they do show it in different ways and in different levels of detail, because each instrument is different and each instrument is picking up different subtle details. You know, they're all CCDs and they all sort of process information differently.
Mm.
And so in some cases you see certain aspects of it more clearly than others. And in other cases, you know, in other versions, like Mars Global Surveyor has a slightly different, it has a different appearance than it might on the Mars Express, the ESA's Mars Express. But no, it's what I expected to see. It's possible that it was once a symmetrical human face. It does appear to have some, if that's the case, it does have some collapse or damage on the right-hand side or the eastern side, or what we call the cliff side,
mm-hmm.
side facing the so-called cliffs at Sidonia. But, you know, Richard said back in 1992, at the UN, that at that time he was beginning to think it wasn't a symmetrical human face, but that it was half human and half lion, much the same way that the ancient Mayans used to have these masks that depicted this human feline sort of hybrid, half and half faces like that. And I tend to agree with him. I've thought that for a while, and I think that it might deliberately have been meant to appear to be two different faces as you mirror them one way and the other.
Hmm.
So I don't agree with the idea that it's been destroyed. It could be eroded. And you know, again, I think my favorite pictures of the face are actually the ESA, the European Space Agency, Mars Express images, because they are directly overhead, almost directly overhead. They do not require much, if any, orthographic correction, which is part of where you get distortion in the NASA images, because they're taken from such poor angles that in order to make it, you know, flat and appear to be, you know, looking straight down on it, you get a lot of stretching and distortion. And when I see that color image of the face from the ESA, the Mars Express mission, I see a clearer, better version of exactly the same face that I saw in the original Viking data in 1976.
Hmm.
Now, there are much higher resolution images from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, but they show detail on the face that to me is clearly marks it as artificial, clearly evidence of construction and so forth. But I love those color pictures because when you show those to people after you show the original Viking data, they look at it and they say, yeah, it looks like a face to me. So, I think that it's really a question of, you have to kind of know what you're looking at and know what they've done to the image before they ever released it to you.
Wow. That's really interesting. I'm going to look for those, ESA, the Mars Express, mission images because I definitely want to see them.
On darkmission.net, on the book website, there is a, on the left-hand side, that says deleted sections, I believe it is. So, in other words, it's parts of the book that didn't make it into the book. And if you click on that, it will take you to a version of the article, the part that was going to go into Dark Mission didn't make it, that was going to be about the Mars Express images. And you can see it all there, including links back to the originals.
So I'd
suggest you go there.
Perfect. Well, I think I've seen them, but... again, I definitely want to check out and compare, as you say. It's really, really interesting. And the reason I brought up this idea here about the bombing, of course, is because what NASA is going to do now here upcoming in October, I don't doubt that you've haven't heard about it. This is the LCROSS program or mission that they're doing, and they're going to bomb in an attempt, I guess, in try to find water or something like that. What's your take on all this, Mike? What is this about?
The idea is that some of the dark, the craters that are in constant darkness at the North and South Poles, may have had water ice, form in them over the years from comet impacts or from maybe natural sources that might have once been on the moon. And, so they're going to test the idea out by taking the LCROSS satellite. It's got there's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and then there's the LCROSS. And they're going to detach a section of it and basically fly it into one of these dark craters at high velocity, and then do a spectral analysis of the dust cloud or the debris cloud that gets kicked up and see if they can find water. And the idea is that if they can find water, then there is a water source that can be exploited for the idea of putting permanent bases on the moon. So that's obviously a desirable thing. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not that suspicious of LCROSS right now. I tend to think it's pretty much the mission that it claims to be.
Mm.
It's going to be very interesting though, because you know we had a similar mission with the comet, with the deep impact mission on the comet a few years ago,
right?
Temple One.
Yes.
And they
finish up on what you talked about. You're mentioning the LCROSS mission, and you don't, and the Temple One, the previous mission that they did.
Right. The Temple One mission was really interesting because they did essentially the same thing where they flew, you know, a chunk of a probe into the comet Temple One and they were going to analyze the debris cloud that was generated. Now, this was really interesting because they, you know, their model, NASA's model, the conventional science model of comets is that they are dirty snowballs. They're chunks of water ice from the early formation of the solar system that were sort of floating around out in the nether regions, and they occasionally get perturbed and tossed into the inner solar system. And so their theory is that they are basically snowballs, they're ice. Dr. Tom Van Flandern, again, the late Dr. Van Flandern, who had the exploded kind of hypothesis as his primary scientific theory, had argued that no, in fact, what they are is all comets are chunks of debris from these exploded planet or planets that were in the orbit of where Mars is now and where the asteroid belt is. And he actually did a lot of work where he traced back all of the long period comet orbits through the celestial mechanics all the way back to these two source points and these two orbits. So his argument is no, what you're going to find is you're going to find that you're going to get rock because all, in his argument, all comets are is they are asteroids that have not yet been stripped of all of their volatiles, all of their water, all of their ice, sodium, and so forth. And as they pass through the solar system, repeatedly through the inner solar system, the sun and the solar wind basically eventually strips all of these off and they become asteroids. That is completely at odds with NASA's theory. And we believe NASA does not want anybody to consider the possibility of the exploded planet hypothesis, because the idea itself is inherently destabilizing. At any rate, they did fly this probe into Temple 1. Yeah. It did strike the comet. It was all recorded. And what they expected to see was water, hydrogen. What they got back was rocks. So, in other words, what was kicked up was exactly what Dr. Van Flandern and Richard had predicted, which was that they would basically get silicates. They would get a rocky cloud of dust in the spectral analysis as opposed to water-filled. And when that happened, they very quickly, within a few hours, took that data off the internet. They stripped it out, and they've been extremely quiet about the results ever since. And they basically have sort of shoved Temple 1 and the whole Deep Impact mission under the rug. So what I've been interested in is, I don't know that there necessarily are any structures in the area that they're going to be dropping LCROSS into, but it will be very interesting if it comes back, if the cloud comes back as a lot of glass and titanium, for instance, which is what we think most of the structures on the moon are made of, as opposed to water, then that's going to also tell us maybe something very interesting about the composition of the moon. So to me, it's not as interesting what actually the results are. It's how they react to whatever the results are. That's what I'm going to be watching for.
Very, very interesting, Mike. And I think that this is a good, unfortunately, we only have an hour here with you today, and we just kind of touched very briefly on some of these topics, and it's, I guess it's time to begin to round things up here. There's a few websites that we want to give out to people again. Obviously, darkemission.net, that's the main website, but also the other one, hopefully that's still up and online, lunaranomalies.com. And we hope to, of course, have you back, Mike, and talk more about some of this stuff. We just kind of barely gotten into scraping the surface of some of these issues.
Yeah, Dark Mission is a huge book. It's about 500 pages. And it's getting bigger because we're coming out with a revised edition this fall. We'll have a bunch of new information in there. Richard's found some cool new stuff on the moon and on Mars. In fact, I think the things that he's found on Mars on some new images are pretty much, you'd have to be crazy to argue that they were natural. They clearly, to me, are evidence of cities, of ruins, of structures on the surface of Mars. And hopefully in a couple months, everybody's going to be able to see them in the new version of the book.
Absolutely. Very good. And again, the main website is darkmission.net. People in the States can check it out and go there. There's other sources. Amazon out there in Sweden, people can go to Bookia, for instance, and get the book there. Well, it's been really interesting having you on. Mike, do you want to round things up here on something? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to tell people there's darkmission.net, which doesn't get updated all that much. There's the Dark Mission blog, which is linked to darkmission.net. I think that's blogspot.darkmission.net I don't remember the actual blog, but it's linked through darkmission.net. There's a Dark Mission blog, and then I have a Facebook page under my name, Mike Barra, and then there's also a Dark Mission Facebook page. And so we'll be updating these as new information comes out, and we'll be posting more and more pictures online and that sort of thing. So that's where I'd like people to go, and hopefully, you know, we'll keep everyone interested and they'll love the new stuff that comes out.
Absolutely. Again, I can mention the blog for those who want to check it out. It's darkmission.blogspot.com, but we'll have these links up on redicecreations.com as well, so people can click through from there easily. Thank you very much for your time, Mike. Great having you here.
And thanks a lot, Henrik, and we'll do it again sometime soon.
All right. That's our program with Mike Barra. Time goes fast when you're having fun. Thank you for listening and for keeping an eye on and an ear to redicecreations.com. We are going to have Neil Kramer back with us on the program soon, Daniel Tatman for another webcast, and we're also going to continue our webcast series with Michael Tessarion. David Icke will hopefully join us soon to talk about the EU-Lisbon Treaty, a very important program. And at the end of this month, we'll have Alfred Weber with us to talk more in depth about the LCROSS mission and the bombing of the moon that we briefly talked about today with Mike. We are going to discuss the possible alien presence on the moon, and where this might lead, if that is true. Go into our radio and webcast archives on redicecreations.com for more. Check out our members area. Sign up if you like what we do and want to have more. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. My name is Henrik. Take good care, and we will be back before you know it.